Welcome to World Crisis Radio. This is your host, Webster Tarpley, in Washington, D.C. And as we tape this broadcast, we're going into the weekend of the World Economic Conference here in Washington, D.C. And we're going to talk about that primarily in today's broadcast. That's going to be our big subject of the day. Let's, however, start off with some news on the Obama transition, the very dangerous situation, transition to fascism 100 days after that to the fascist corporate state. Let's just do some scorekeeping here. First of all, we have Rahm Emanuel, the reactionary warmonger, vicious thug, who will be the chief of staff of the Obama White House. It's clear, obviously. Barkey will be a puppet president in the Bush tradition, in the Reagan tradition. He'll be just another puppet. And now the resident controllers, the White House Palace Guard, the Praetorians, are being placed around him. One such controller and thug, Rahm Emanuel, the man who in 2006 demanded that if you wanted to get money from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee to run for Congress, you had one thing you had to be, and that was a warmonger. You had to be a finish-the-job-in-Iraq Democrat. So a warmonger Democrat and vicious thug, the guy who sends dead fish to his enemies, the guy who plunges the steak knife into the table and recites a list of proscriptions, the people who are going to get it, each one of them dead, according to Rahm Emanuel. Rahm Emanuel, who spent the first Gulf War as a member of the Israeli Defense Forces, may have lost his U.S. citizenship in the process, serving under the armed forces of a foreign state. And Rahm Emanuel, most of all, who is associated with his own slave labor program. He wants 100 hours a year from everybody in every school, and he wants a three-month period of forced labor. So you're going to become a member of Rahm Emanuel's Freiwilliger Arbeitsdienst, so-called voluntary labor service, not voluntary, and it's a prelude to other things. So Rahm Emanuel is right on the same page with Barkey when it comes to the fascist corporate state and the institutionalization of compulsory government-sponsored militias, which will be there for slave labor. Slave labor for whom? For Wall Street, for Soros, Rockefeller, Goldman Sachs, and the others who will get the benefit of this because they're the bondholders. They are the stakeholders in this entire enterprise. That's Rahm Emanuel. The other important developments, the Polish missile crisis. Last weekend, Obama spoke to President Kaczynski of Poland. This is the Kaczynski twin who's still in power. His twin brother was ousted in favor of the Prime Minister Tusk. But in the course of this, President Kaczynski of Poland quite normally asked Obama, well, what about these missiles? Are we going to get anti-ballistic missiles put into Poland, yes or no? And according to Kaczynski, Barkey Obama said, yes, this is all on track. I will not interfere with it. This then, of course, went around the world. This was dropping the mask. Obama is supposed to be the peace angel. He's supposed to be Sir Neville Chamberlain with an umbrella. But he dropped the mask too quickly, so Barkey had to backtrack fast with the usual mendacity and duplicity. He then turned around and said, no, I didn't make any commitments about putting missiles into Poland. I hope some people in Russia who have been peddling the idiot Obama line will wake up as a result of that, and also in Western Europe, where the Obama-file mania has been considerable. If Obama is a peace angel, let him do one thing. Let him now announce formally that there will be no Polish ABM missiles. The Polish missile crisis is called off. President Medvedev of Russia has said, look, just drop the missiles into Poland, and Russia will not deploy these short-range Iskander countermissiles into the Kaliningrad exclave of Russia, that is what used to be East Prussia, right? Kaliningrad, Königsberg, separated from most of European Russia by the by a new Polish corridor, I guess we'd have to say. So the Russians are interested in avoiding the conflict, and we'll get back to this in a minute. But if Obama is the peace angel, you say, oh, left liberals, then why doesn't he just come out right now and say that the Polish missile crisis will not happen? On Iraq, antiwar.com has finally opened their eyes. After endorsing Obama in the Democratic primaries, the people over at Justin Raimondo's antiwar.com have finally realized that with Obama, there is no timetable for withdrawing from Iraq. The potential now, the perspective opens up. Endless war in Iraq with Obama. We've also got Obama's plans for Afghan escalation, and of course the secret of that is what we're now seeing just about every day. New attacks into Pakistan, new Predator missile attacks, a dozen here, 25 there, 10 over someplace else, a constant slaughter of Pakistanis on the ground in their own country with no bilateral coordination, acts of international banditry, acts of war, and Obama says, bring on more. He wants more Pakistanis mowed down and massacred. That's Obama, the peace angel. We've also got Podesta, John Podesta, the retread from the office of Daschle, retread from the Clinton administration, the dark side of the Clintons, to be sure. And Podesta on television has said that there will be a wide use of executive orders by Barkey in the first several weeks and months of his regime. This reminds us of Mussolini, who pioneered the use of the decree law, the decreto legge, as he called it. The decree law was, of course, Mussolini's favorite instrument for getting things done. When he couldn't get a parliamentary majority, he would just go around it with a decree law. So decree laws, in this lingo, executive orders, says Podesta, will be the staple of Obama's administration. One of the things he will try to do is to shut down energy production. Any drilling for oil in offshore areas or anyplace else will be stopped cold by Barkey Obama's executive orders designed to please the rich parasitical elitists over at the Sierra Club, the Nature Conservancy, the Wilderness Society, the Friends of the Earth, and other organizations of rich Malthusian elitists who care about the polar bears. They don't care whether your kid gets health care or whether you starve, but the spotted owl, of course, is sacrosanct. We also have Valerie Jarrett. This woman is Barkey. She was, during the campaign, Barkey's traveling school mom. She was constantly with him on the road. Valerie Jarrett is essentially the female version of Tony Rezko, not yet indicted, not yet convicted. Valerie Jarrett is part of the Chicago housing graft community. You can read all about this in Obama, Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography. Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography, available at Amazon.com. There's a whole part in there about Valerie Jarrett. This is the woman who gave Michelle Obama her first job in the corrupt graft office of Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. So Jarrett is up to her neck, up to her eyeballs in graft, corruption, influence peddling, and other filthy operations of the dirty Chicago machine, and above all of the bipartisan Illinois combine. You can read all about that too in Obama the unauthorized biography. Guy Jarrett says Obama will be ready to rule. He will rule the United States from the White House. Sorry, under this Constitution, nobody rules. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome welcome back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpey speaking from Washington, D.C., reminding you that you cannot understand what is going on from day to day anymore unless you have thoroughly studied Obama the Postmodern Coup, the Making of a Manchurian Candidate, as well as Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. Both of those books available from Amazon.com. The German edition of Obama the Postmodern Coup remains the leading bestseller on Obama in Germany, and other international editions are in the works. People are tired of the steady diet of adulation and fawning celebrity coverage for Barky Obama, the brutal new kingpin of this new regime here in the United States. The transition into postmodern fascism or social fascism, if that is the word. One or two final notes. In addition to the Rahm Emanuel appointment, we're going to have the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe has come out with their report on what happened in Georgia over by Russia in this past August. And the finding is, of course, is that Georgia, under the tin pot dictator Saakashvili, is the aggressor. They are the aggressors. Even the OSCE, the Helsinki Monitoring Organization, comes to the unavoidable conclusion Georgia was the aggressor. So all of these idiotic statements from Obama, McCain, Bush, and the NATO bureaucracy in Brussels, all of these things go into the dustbin of history. Time to roll back all of that stuff. Let's also talk for a second about the transition to the Obama regime. Maybe we'll do that in a later segment. Let's get right into the economic news, because right now here in Washington, a lot of buzz, a lot of world leaders are arriving for this conference. It's similar in some ways to the old Smithsonian conference, where they tried to set up some kind of a follow-on to Bretton Woods. That was, of course, a failure. It was swept away in a matter of months. So this time it's going to be over at the old pension building, the National Building Museum. You know, this building with the huge columns, which, figuratively speaking, might be a dangerous conference to go to. The point about this conference, though, is the various powers coming together are going to be talking about the leading proposals coming from the U.S. and the British are for an international dictatorship of the International Monetary Fund, a world financial and economic dictatorship coming from the International Monetary Fund. I was able to get a five-point summary of the leading issues there, which I posted at actindependent.org and other websites. You can see it at Rents. You can see it elsewhere. It is an international dictatorship of the IMF. People have been very focused in recent years about things like the Amero. It never seemed to me that this was the leading cutting-edge option of the international finance oligarchs, the Anglo-American bankers. No, it's the International Monetary Fund, and this has a history, which we can go through in a minute. But the basic idea is that under today's economic and financial arrangements, if a country is about to go bankrupt, and all of them are, you've got to turn to the International Monetary Fund and submit to their dictates, their list of what is called conditionalities, in order to get loans. And that's the way they want to do it. They want to increase, they want to enhance the ability of the International Monetary Fund to put individual countries under a regime of special surveillance, meaning that the IMF comes in and tells your elected government what to do in complete contradiction to your laws, your constitution, and the will of your people. The International Monetary Fund embodies the dictates of the international financier ruling class, mainly centered in London and Wall Street. Now, we're seeing here in the Washington Post of today, Friday, November 14th, 2008, a proposal, first of all, for a college of supervisors, a new body to supervise the regulation of global financial institutions. The College of Supervisors would bring together international regulators to coordinate oversight of the world's 30 largest financial institutions. It would add an extra level of scrutiny to the way that banks are monitored. You've also got the U.S., Europe, Japan, and some developing countries to create an early warning system to detect weakness in the global financial system before this reaches epic proportions. Well, the weakness, of course, is the deindustrialization of the United States, the systematic destruction of the industrial base, starting with Paul Adolf Volcker at the Federal Reserve, the trilateral Jimmy Carter man who raised the prime rate to 22% back in 1980. So we've also got other measures that they're talking about, but the principal thing is to centralize the scrutiny, the surveillance in the International Monetary Fund. Now let's look for a second here. Well, there are institutions that they want to use. It's not just the IMF. There are a couple of others. There is, of course, the World Bank. That's a cop to make sure that your technology is backward enough for the position that you have been assigned. They push appropriate technology, meaning if you want modern energy production, nuclear energy, high-tech factories, real capital investment, you're told, no, that's not appropriate technology. You're a backward country. You get backward technology that's three generations back. Try some windmills. Try some solar cells. This is the logic of imperialism. But there's also the Financial Stability Forum. The Financial Stability Forum brings together senior representatives of central banks, finance ministries, national and international regulators. This is not a prominent institution, but it was created in the wake of the so-called Asian contagion, long-term capital management, and Russian state bankruptcy crises of 1997 to 1998. It's a very small group, but it will be beefed up, it is expected, as a result of these proceedings here in Washington, D.C. There's also the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. Basel I, Basel II, they're now obviously going to go for Basel III. This is to establish various guidelines for accounting, capital standards, and the rest of this. But you notice, the common denominator of all this stuff is it's purely in the world of paper. If you wanted to have a conference that would lead to world economic recovery, you would have to identify a list of, say, 20 to 25 great projects. Let's say the linking of the Nile River with the Congo through a series of canals to create an internal waterway for Africa, a Dakar to Djibouti magnetic levitation railway, a Cape to Cairo magnetic levitation railway. Same thing in Latin America. Build a magnetic levitation railway from Paris to Moscow to Vladivostok, and so on, and then finance that with 1% interest loans from an international lending authority. Restart world production. There's no hint of that in any of this.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Here in Washington, D.C., where the various world leaders are now gathering for this summit of monetarism and derivatives, but we hope that an opposition will emerge. The idea here being basically two things. One is that if you want to put the world under International Monetary Fund dictatorship, this essentially means the dictatorship, once again, of our dear friends, the U.S. and British imperialists, the Anglo-American bankers, the London, City of London to Wall Street axis. There are some people in the world who don't want to be under the dictatorship of those monetarist, usurious, derivatives-hawking bankers. And the resistance hopefully starts with the BRIC, the Brazil, Russia, India, China combination. There are also some others. There are some people in Europe who might be at least not enthusiastic. Therefore, we're hoping that Brazil, Russia, India, China, or any combination thereof will be sufficient to block this conference. We want this conference to break down. We don't want any result out of this conference. Everything that they're doing is harmful. Some of it is absolutely monstrous. We don't want to have mankind crucified on a cross of derivatives. That is the problem today. The most dangerous enemy, of course, is Gordon Brown. Let's take a look at the people coming to town. First of all, Gordon Brown of Great Britain, who wants to essentially usurp the role of Lord Montague Norman back in the 1920s and 30s to be the currency and financial dictator of the world. This, of course, is Gordon Brown coming from the land of Northern Rock, where they have institutionalized banking bailouts starting before anybody else in the world in response to the Northern Rock crisis of 14, 15 months ago. Let's see who else is coming. Argentina, under President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. This is a country which has some potential for fighting back against the International Monetary Fund. They have done more in Argentina to fight the IMF during this past decade than just about any other country in the world. They have a tremendous debt problem. What they need, of course, is a debt moratorium. That ought to be one of the fundamental demands for all of these countries. The poorer you are, the more you need it, but everybody needs it. That is to say, a debt moratorium, a freeze on international financial debt. That would also go for Brazil. Here we have President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil. Now, this is a sort of a fake leftist. This is somebody who pretends to be a leftist, but really has capitulated on most things to the International Monetary Fund. But still, they've got tremendous debt. They've got tremendous economic problems. They ought to rebel. Britain, we've already gone through. This is the flagship of finance oligarchy in the world and, of course, has been for centuries. We're going to have Prime Minister Stephen Harper of Canada coming in. He just won an election. I would call on people in Canada to put out these lines against the IMF, against the World Bank, and against this new financial architecture. President Hu Jintao of China will be here. Now, the Chinese, in many ways, are the most interesting. They've just come up with a real economic recovery program, and that is to say they're spending about $585 billion. Most of this is not going to try to prop up toxic paper, but it's going for real productive activity. In other words, the building of infrastructure, the building of housing, the increase of food production, and the delivery of medical and other social welfare services to the Chinese population, special emphasis on the countryside. In terms of infrastructure, it means railroads, which in the case of China means magnetic levitation and fast rail construction. It means various kinds of superhighway building, roads, new airports, and the rest of it. They've also got problems left over from various floods and earthquakes of the past 4 to 5 years. Medical services. This is a real economic recovery program. It is not a derivatives program. It's not a bank bailout program. It's not $700 billion to buy toxic paper. It focuses on production. It is, to that extent, a New Deal program. How ironic that the New Deal is not implemented here in the United States, but other people around the world have studied world history enough to know that New Deal is the only way out of this stuff. Monetarism won't do it. The free market nonsense, which, of course, is passé, nor will the fascist corporate state do it. France, Nicolas Sarkozy leaving his actress consort behind. Sarkozy is going to be here. Sarkozy is essentially pushing for a single international regulator. That is a kind of a new Montague Norman. This, of course, helps to push. It's a kind of a Mutt and Jeff act with Gordon Brown, I think, where Sarkozy comes out as an extreme regulator so that Gordon Brown can come in with his proposals for the glorification of derivatives and the building of a new world financial order based on toxic paper. Again, this stuff is going to last about as long as the Smithsonian Conference of 1973 lasted. Very, very short period of time. From India, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh This is a country that has some potential to rebel, but India is always in this gray area because of the oligarchy built into the cultural and religious institutions and the 250 years of British colonial domination. India is always one that wavers. They could easily become a tool of the Anglo-Americans, although they can also go the other way if the magnetism of Russia, China, and others increases. From Indonesia, President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono. This is, of course, the world's biggest Islamic country. They ought to be fighting back. They, of course, took it on the chin 10 years ago in the Asian contagion. Italy, this is a wild card. Berlusconi is the most pro-Russian of any leader in Western Europe. And Berlusconi is somebody who knows that his future politically, economically depends on East-West energy deals between the Italian companies and Russia. He enjoys a kind of a special status among all the Western Europeans as a friend of Putin, personal friend, and the institutional relationships are also there. So watch for Berlusconi to be a possible wild card. Germany is a country which, of course, economically needs East-West trade with Russia like it needs air to breathe. The problem is you've got this pathetic woman, Prime Minister Chancellor Merkel, who, of course, because of her particular psychological problems, tends to go with the Anglo-Americans. Japan comes into town with Prime Minister Aso, a new and, I think, relatively uncertain element in this entire thing, a possible wild card maybe, but just because so little is known about him. The Japanese, of course, have a powerful incentive to join in the Chinese economic recovery program, but at the same time, there's a powerful pro-British banking interest in the country, which you have to watch out for. Mexico, with Felipe Calderon, the infamous Fecal, this is not very promising, of course, linked to the United States with all kinds of free trade deals. Not much to expect there, but you never know. Russia with Medvedev, this is the most interesting. The Russians have been the most outspoken that this crisis comes from the United States. The U.S. is once again inflicting a world economic depression on the world after 1929. That's one way to look at it. So Medvedev is a person who could stand up and say no, yet. The other thing, of course, is that if you've got the Polish missiles coming in, you've got linkage between these issues, whether anybody likes it or not. You cannot simply say, well, we're going to put you under IMF, that is U.S. and British economic dictatorship, and we're going to threaten you with missiles from Poland. So Russia is the leading candidate to take the to seize leadership of an anti-derivatives, anti-U.S., anti-British bloc in the world. Saudi Arabia is the only Arab country that's going to be here, interestingly enough, and we'll get to them in just a minute when we return.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNLive.com today.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C., reminding you of the indispensable role of Obama, the postmodern coup, the making of a Manchurian candidate, and Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography, both available from Amazon.com. Get them now or go blind into this terrible time, which is now upon us. Just completing this list of the group of 20 that are going to be here in Washington, D.C., starting basically today for a conference to be held tomorrow. Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia, the only Arab country, notice, no Egypt, no Algeria, no Sudan, no Iraq. You'd think they could bring Iraq. That would be a puppet voice for them, at least to some degree. Notice also Iran is not invited among the Muslim countries. Saudi Arabia, they've taken it on the chin. They've just had their stock market collapse by about 50 to 60%. The oil price is down now into the 50s, 56, 55 right now in real time. And this is a country that is looking into the abyss. What the plan is, though, the Anglo-Americans want to bilk them. The Anglo-Americans want to say to China and Saudi Arabia, you guys have all those dollars. You should now invest them in third world, especially African development. What they mean by that is you should get in there and pay the foreign debts of those countries. You can't do anything for Africa or any place else in the underdeveloped world without wiping the slate clean with no conditions. Comprehensive, immediate, total, open-ended debt moratorium. Freeze. Not exactly a cancellation, but it's close. Freeze on all payments of interest and principal on international financial debt. And that then brings us to South Africa. They're the only black Africans invited to this. Another strange situation. This is no longer Mbeki now. This is President Motlanthe of South Africa. Be interesting to hear what this might be. Their credit rating has recently been downgraded by Fitch from stable to negative. This is amazing. These agencies that can attack sovereign countries and provoke financial crises just on the basis of bureaucratic fiat. And, of course, the CIA has its tentacles in all of these agencies. South Africa is followed by South Korea with Lee Myung-bak. This is a country where the chai bowls, of course, are big, these international conglomerates. They need to export. Their credit rating has been downgraded. This, however, is a country that has a significant industrial infrastructure. Turkey, with Prime Minister Erdogan. Now, here, of course, the politics looms very, very large. It has a large banking establishment, which has been in real trouble. They've been on the verge of collapse. In terms of the currency, the banking system, and the stock market. But this is a country that has responded to the Georgian crisis of this past summer by gravitating, if anything, closer to Russia, therefore an interesting possibility. Barkey won't be at the conference. Barkey is sending Jim Leach, the International Monetary Fund puppet and hack from the Congress. He was voted out in 2006, congressman from Iowa. He's going to be there along with Madeleine Albright, the charming lady who said that all those hundreds of thousands of children starving to death in Iraq under the sanctions were well worth it. So, again, what's the possibility with this? The only possible outcome is block it, shut it down, prevent them from visiting any of this nonsense on the world. The only hope we have is that the arrogance of the U.S. and the British will prevent any of this stuff. And notice, when they say regulation, they mean financial regulation exclusively. They're simply trying to ward off new rounds of panic and create layers of dictatorship. They're not talking about child labor prohibitions. They're not talking about institutionalizing the eight-hour day or the right to have a union. They don't mean, when they say regulation, they don't mean any of that. So that's the situation. Now, in terms of the International Monetary Fund, for people who don't know this stuff, it is important to know it. The International Monetary Fund grows out of informal contacts that were held all during the 1920s into the 1930s between Lord Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England. He was the head of the Bank of England for about 20, 25 years between the wars to the end of World War II. Currency dictator of Europe, did more than anybody to create the world economic depression of the 1930s. And it's not really 1929 and the New York stock market crash, which was the big thing. It was the September 1931 default of the British pound, when the British defaulted on gold payment and destroyed the only monetary system that the world had at the time, which was the sterling, pound sterling bill of exchange. That is what made the depression of the 1930s so long-lasting and so difficult. And that was why it was so difficult for Roosevelt to get out of it on a single country basis. You would have had to reorganize the world with a new monetary system. That's finally what happened at Bretton Woods as a result of the U.S. winning World War II. So that was the limit for Franklin D. Roosevelt. The New Deal worked fine, but it could not immediately reorder the world as long as you had the British Empire and Hitler allied with them, and then indeed Stalin allied with Hitler. So it made a very, very difficult situation. In 1944, the IMF was created. It was supposed to be have a limited role, but as the years, the decades went on, and the monetarists, the Friedmanites, and the Austrian school boys grew in power, it got to be more and more of an international regulatory agency that could come in and interfere with national sovereignty with IMF diktat. And here's the thing. The French had to go to the IMF repeatedly in the 50s. De Gaulle put a stop to that. The Italians and the British had to go in the 1970s. All kinds of third world countries have had to go repeatedly. What is the issue? If you're about to go bankrupt, you go to the IMF and you say to them, look, we need a loan from you, from the IMF, which at the same time will certify that we're creditworthy so that private capital can also come in. The IMF says, wonderful. Here is a letter of conditionalities, a letter of intent that you have to sign in order to get this money from us. What are the items on these letters? It's based on something that has, it became known ultimately as the Washington Consensus. Pure monetarism, pure Milton Friedman, pure von Hayek, pure Austrian school crackpot economics. First of all, deregulation. Have you got any child labor laws? Get rid of them. You got Wages and Hours Act? Get rid of those. Do you have guarantees of trade union rights? Get rid of them. Privatization. Do you have a state sector? You've got to dump it immediately at bargain basement prices so the finance oligarchs can buy it up. Have you got minimum wage? Get rid of that. Deregulate that. Let's have some union busting. Let's have free trade. No protective tariff, only free trade, free market. The IMF banner really ought to say free market on there, because that's what they push. They say then cut government spending, balance your budget. The same cry from Herbert Hoover to other people that we hear about today. Globalization, don't allow any barriers to the flow of hot money in or hot money out. And therefore, based on all of this, the race to the bottom. Now, it means, among other things, that if you have a social safety net, the IMF wants you to destroy it. Do you have Social Security? Privatize it. Do you have Medicare and Medicaid? Either you abolish them or you privatize them. Do you have unemployment benefits? Cut them. Do you have women, infants, children, protein for expectant mothers? Cut that or junk it. Do you have Head Start, a breakfast for poor kids so that they can get a start on the day in school? Get rid of all that. Does this sound familiar? The International Monetary Fund dictates are the same as those advanced by various spokesmen for the so-called free market. And this is not liberation. This is the International Monetary Fund's dictatorship. Many countries have fought very, very hard to avoid the horrendous social consequences and indeed the increased rates of mortality, because that's what all this leads to, that you get under the IMF. And this was used as a war measure, really economic warfare against Russia under the Jeffrey Sachs, Anders Asslund shock therapy of the 1990s, inflicted by guys like Summers, Larry Summers, and Bob Rubin, starting under Bush and extending them on automatic pilot into the Clinton years. So that's the International Monetary Fund. So if you say you're going to go under IMF dictatorship, get ready for all of that. Deregulation, privatization, union busting, the destruction of the social safety net, and the race to the bottom. Don't go there. Webster Thompson here in Washington, D.C. We're heading now into this Washington Financial Conference of the Group of 20, the historical analog I mentioned before, the Smithsonian Conference of the Group of 10, held in Washington, December 1971, was an attempt to reestablish the regime of fixed parities as exchange rates, but it failed, and it fell apart by the summer of 1972 in a crisis far less severe than the current one. So whatever comes out of this Washington conference, I think we can safely assume will be swept away within about 6 months. But in the meantime, they can do a lot of mischief One of the other aspects, in addition to the BRIC, the Brazil, Russia, India, China opposition, and those are people that you need to support to the extent that they're fighting the London Wall Street finance oligarchy, is, of course, the people in Congress, be they right-wing Republicans or New Deal Democrats or anything like that, who just don't like these measures. We're after the International Economic Conference, we're going to have a lame duck session of the U.S. Congress. Let's say a few words about that. The main idea is wipe out derivatives, wipe out hedge funds, outlaw adjustable rate mortgages. Don't have any more bailouts. No more bailouts. Roll back the current bailout. Reroute the $700 billion into something that looks like the Chinese plan. Reroute the $700 billion into nationwide rebuilding of infrastructure, rebuilding railroads, the interstate highway system, electrical grids, water systems, tremendous amounts of infrastructure. Every major city has got water systems that are now about 100 years old. The electrical grid is collapsing. Freight rail is collapsing. Passenger rail is collapsing. We need urban mass transit. You want to reduce the numbers of cars on the road? Great idea. Build attractive high-speed urban mass transit. Put the $700 billion into that and get it down to a one-half of 1% or at most a 1% interest rate, but no more money for toxic derivatives and related nonsense. Sorry? Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm told by the studio that we're now joined by Phil Berg, the courageous attorney who, of course, went to the United States Supreme Court starting in late August and then, got to the Supreme Court by several days before the election. And we're always glad to have Phil on to give us an update. Phil, take it away. Yes, go ahead. We can hear you. All right, we're having technical difficulties. He may just be going through one of the tunnels in our 100-year-old railway system. This is one of the problems, right? If you want to go from Philadelphia to Washington, you're on tracks that essentially go back to the period before the Civil War. So that's what we ought to be rebuilding. So the other question, though, is General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, what do you do about them? The first thing is you save them. You've got to maintain your machine tool capability. You've got to maintain your tool and die. You've got to keep those skilled workers together. You cannot lose those productive capabilities. The problem is Chrysler has been taken over by Cerberus Hedge Fund. We got to save Chrysler from Cerberus Hedge Fund. That's a gang of asset strippers led by former Treasury Secretary White of the Bush gang. Chrysler has to be nationalized and run under government supervision for the purpose of keeping those productive capabilities together. Now let's try Phil Berg again. Phil, can you hear us?
Can you hear me fine?
We just want to get an update. We're so glad to have you with us. Everybody's an enthusiastic supporter of what you're doing. So give us the word.
Well, ObamaCrimes.com, we're moving ahead. We're waiting on the U.S. Supreme Court. The opposition has till December 1st to file responses. They want to. We also have a number of attorneys that are apparently going to file friend of the court briefs to hopefully help our position. In addition, I filed a lawsuit, which I really can't discuss much, but I'm trying to do a backdoor effort to can produce documentation that he is natural-born, which he's not. Born in Kenya. This is the biggest hoax upon the American public. We're now looking at actions how to take on the Electoral College against the electors because they can only vote for qualified candidates. That is being run in this weekend. Washington Times, a full-page color ad, and we're hoping to raise other money so we can put these ad papers across the country. So that's basically where we are at this point.
Tremendous. So we should all get the Washington Times tomorrow. The Washington Times, the conservative daily published here in Washington, the alternative to the Washington Post. Well, I'm afraid we're not getting Phil Berg very clear, but I think you heard it. He's pushing ahead with the ObamaCrimes.com website, which is now well over 100 million hits. There is, of course, this case that goes forward. The temporary injunctive relief from Justice Souter was denied prior to the election, but the case goes on because, of course, from the legal technical point of view under U.S. law. Nobody has been elected. We haven't even had the meetings of the electors in the various state capitals, which is sometime around the 10th or so of December, and they will meet then in those state capitals, but there's no official tally of those votes until the pieces of certified mail and registered mail are opened in the House of Representatives in the first week of January. And as Phil says, the electors are not allowed to vote for presidential candidates that are not qualified for the office. So there is another avenue. And that means if you know any of these electors or can contact them, you want to remind them that Obama is not a citizen of the United States, or if he wants to prove it, let him come forward with the vault copy, the detailed birth certificate, which proves at least that he was born in the United States, and then he would have to address the question of whether he then became a naturalized citizen of Indonesia. So again, the deadline, as Phil just told us, for the response from the Obama camp in the legal proceeding is December 1st. We've got some distinguished amici curiae, friends of the court, coming in. So Phil keeps fighting, and I'm sure we're going to have more from him next week, maybe with the technical situation being a little bit better. So we thank Phil Berg, and we urge everybody to go to ObamaCrimes.com, make a contribution, support him, make your voice heard. All of this stuff is politically important, and it's just a continuum of resistance, right? During the election, after the election, in the transition, in the 100 days, and then in the run-up to the congressional election of November 2010, you just got to keep fighting. Get active or get radioactive. And then on the economic front, let's go back to that. The question is, what do you do about General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler? Are they eligible for money from the $700 billion? We have Paulson, the agent of Goldman Sachs, the arch-monetarist derivatives merchant whose stock and trade is poisonous, toxic derivatives paper, saying, no, the big three automakers don't qualify because they have to show proof of viability. Well, don't look now, Paulson, but your dear friends at Goldman Sachs are on a death spiral. They're on life support. They would be long gone without any if it hadn't been for the intervention of the federal government under your conflict of interest ridden auspices. Whereas these three auto companies at least have real capital goods, real assembly lines, real machine tools, real tool and die. They don't trade on derivatives paper. Therefore, that's why they have to be saved. This is a case in point. There is a very rigorous distinction between what is productive and what is not productive. And then we can go beyond not productive to toxic, poisonous, destructive, and incompatible with human society, and that would be the world of the derivatives, which is where our dear friend Paulson lives. And the Washington Post, by the way, in the course of looking forward to the Smithsonian, admitted that this is a derivatives crisis. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for Freak Talk Radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Here in Washington, D.C., as we go towards the Washington Economic Financial Conference of the 16th, the 15th, the 16th of November, the Washington Post reporting on the situation of the Italian banking system notes Italian businesses face a slowdown and the number of unemployed is rising. Still, this country has a lot going for it, namely, no Italian banks have failed. The country's banking system avoided the risky financial instruments that have sunk other economies. This means derivatives, people. Now, if you listen to Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly, The answer of their listeners is, what's a derivative? Well, the derivatives are simply that commodity, fictitious commodity, fictitious capital instrument, toxic paper, of which there are $1.5 quadrillion in the world. So that's the center of the current crisis, not poor schmoes getting cheap mortgages in rundown inner city neighborhoods. That's not how the world banking system was pitched into crisis. So anyway, the general rundown on the economic bailout, try to wrench that money out of the hands of Wall Street and use it to preserve industrial jobs. Try to use it to launch a rebuilding of infrastructure, a reindustrialization program, and reconversion. The United Auto Workers after World War II came up with interesting plans. How do you reconvert from war production to civilian production of useful commodities? These were not successfully applied, but the idea of it is there. Chrysler, General Motors, and Ford obviously need to reconvert to a significant degree. How about instead of using these chimeras of maintaining the model of the individual automobile with an internal combustion engine, obviously you're going to need those, but why not reconvert significant parts of Chrysler, Ford, GM into locomotives and rail cars for urban mass transit? You can also rebuild it into other areas. I'm sure technical experts can point out a whole number of areas. How about modular housing for the third world? And again, that in order for that to be financed, you've got to have an international lending authority to make it happen. So all of this is possible, but not if you put $700 billion into the support of the toxic financial paper. Now, we have coming up on the 22nd of November, the End the Fed demonstrations. And naturally, this is useful to have public attention drawn to the crimes of the Federal Reserve. However, let us address the problem of monetarism, of Milton Friedman Chicago School and von Hayek Austrian School monetarism, which is posed by some of the agitation that's going on. End the Fed, in my book, means nationalize the Fed. Submit it to the only thing we have under our system, which is public law, passed by the House, passed by the Senate, signed by the President. Do not allow cliques of nameless, unelected, unaccountable bankers to set interest rates in the Federal Open Market Committee or carry out the non-regulation, which we've had lately under Greenspan and Bernanke. The greatest crime of the Federal Reserve in the 1990s was to support and to promote and foster the deadly derivatives bubble, the 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives which are now destroying the world economy. Greenspan was responsible, but notice, this was a problem of not enough regulation. It was the free market when it was allowed to proceed unchecked in wild capitalism. That is what brought you the 1.5 quadrillion of derivatives. We needed an early intervention by government, by Brooks Liebhorn, the Clinton administration, by Rubin, by Larry Summers, and above all by Greenspan to say, no, derivatives are going to destroy the system. We cannot have any more derivatives. And instead, that's what we didn't get. So there is a role for an institution there, but not if it's controlled by Wall Street. And, of course, all Greenspan is a speaking tube for J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and the rest of them. What we've got to do is to apply what I've suggested, which is the Main Street lending facility. In other words, nationalize the Fed. If you have the political clout to simply nationalize it, that's great. Right now, clearly, we don't. But you want to then nationalize at least a part of it and say, all right, let's open up a Main Street lending facility, $1 trillion of 0 to 1% to 0.5% interest rate federal loans, federal lending, not federal spending, cheap federal credit for productive activities. And the obvious thing to do would be to launch a maglev transcontinental railway, rebuild the U.S. canal system, water systems, the electricity grid, the interstate highway system, schools, hospitals, and all the rest of that. In other words, a massive public works program where the subcontractors and contractors of those programs would have the right to go to a local bank with their contractor vendor number, and the guaranteed discount of that by the Federal Reserve would make it possible for us to reflate the local banking system, the regional banking system, keeping those institutions alive. Instead, what we have today is the opposite. We have everything going to the Wall Street parasites, bandits, hedge fund hyenas, and derivatives pirates. So what we need is reindustrialization. There's also a problem here about the value of currency. People seem to think that values of currency are determined by gold. No, not in today's world. The value of a national currency is determined by the productive power in industry, mining, agriculture, real economy, real physical commodity production of the country involved. In other words, if you want to have a strong dollar, you've got to start manufacturing things that the rest of the world wants to buy. And if they need dollars to buy something that you're making that you can't get anywhere else, that determines the international value of the dollar. It doesn't matter how much gold you have. And of course, the problem with all of the stuff that none of these gold enthusiasts seem to realize, the ones who want to go back to a gold coin standard, is that if you went back to a gold coin standard, all of the crushing $1 trillion of household debt, just for credit card debt, before we even get into mortgage debt, you would be increasing that debt into the ionosphere. You'd be working all of your life to pay off a $5,000 credit card debt. It would become the crucifixion again on the cross of gold. The whole point of "you shall not crucify mankind on a cross of gold" is that if you make your currency based on gold, you get a tremendous deflation. And deflation right now is not what anybody needs. If you have any debt, if you have credit card debt, mortgage debt, consumer debt, charge plates from department stores, look at the debt you've got and ask yourself if you'd like to have that debt multiplied by 5 or 10 or 100, because that's what would happen if you went back to hard money in terms of a currency issue limited by the amount of gold in the treasury. That's not the way. Increase production and you'll have demand for currency. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So we're left with our calls, clarion calls. No to the IMF world financial dictatorship. Nationalize the Fed. No more bailouts for financial parasites. Open up a Main Street lending window for all kinds of productive activity, but not for financial speculation, drug money laundering, gambling, prostitution, and other sociopathic activities. And yes, we can tell the difference. We do know the difference between things that are productive and things that are parasitical. This is a rigorous scientific distinction. And if you don't go for real, physical, hard commodity production at an advanced science and advanced technology and advanced energy production, then you collapse. You are gone. How do you think all these civilizations have collapsed from the inside due to oligarchical monetarist control? And that is what you want to avoid. Now, you look at that Chinese $585 billion New Deal-style program. That will make China the most powerful country in the world. If the U.S. is putting $700 billion into toxic derivatives paper and the Chinese are putting $585 billion into infrastructure, transportation, energy production, housing and food and medical care for their people, China will dominate the world. So there it is, in a nutshell. If you want monetarism, if you want the free market, if you're so in love with Milton Friedman and the Chicago School and Hayek and the Austrian School and all of these slogans about the free market, well, then you're choosing decadence, decline, and the extinction of these institutions, which I think still have a great deal to offer, but not under this illusion. There's also the illusion that goes with it, is that the farther back you go, the more and more free market people you find, that the founding fathers were all free marketeers. This is absolutely lunatic. Even before the founding fathers, you've got Governor John Winthrop of the Massachusetts Bay Colony is an unabashed dirigist. All of these people are mercantilists, protectionists, dirigists. There's even a word, cameralists. That's what they are. They believe that the task of government is to foster broad-based economic development, increase of science, increase of technology, rising standards of living, human progress, as it's known. They do not propose the free market. That goes for Governor Winthrop of Massachusetts. It goes for Benjamin Franklin, who founded the Postal Service, a dirigist. It goes, above all, for Alexander Hamilton, probably the greatest dirigist, mercantilist, protectionist, and cameralist in the history of the world, without whom the United States would have collapsed on the British death watch in about 10 to 15 years. If we'd had a free marketeer back in the George Washington administration, then the British would have replanted their flag on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., or at the Federal Hall in New York City, where Bush actually spoke yesterday about free markets. So you've also then got Henry Clay of Kentucky. What about him? This is called the American system. National bank, protective tariff, promote science and industry, and build infrastructure at national expense. You've got Matthew Carey and Henry Carey, principal advisors to Abraham Lincoln. Same idea, protective tariff, national bank. Lincoln himself, disciple of Henry Clay of Kentucky. Remember that during the 19th century, the free trade, free market interest is the Confederate interest, and then it's the Wall Street interest. We've also got to mention people like Justin Morrill of Vermont, the Morrill Act, the Transcontinental Railway, the land-grant colleges, and the Morrill Tariff, the best protective tariff that the U.S. had up to that point in the 19th century. We've also then got the prairie populist of the 1880s and 1890s, people who talked about dirigistic measures, regulation to curb the power of Wall Street. And then finally, the flowering of all of this in the New Deal, which did fight the Depression effectively. And if we go back to Herbert Hoover economics, you're going to go back to a Herbert Hoover, Hooverville standard of living. The New Deal is the first time in human history that the middle class becomes the numerical majority of the entire population. If you think, as some are arguing today, that World War II automatically ended the Depression, this is also a fallacy. Today we have two wars and a Depression. War by itself does not end Depression. If your economic policies are wrong, as they are today, you can have war or multiple wars and a Depression at the same time. The genius, of course, is Lend-Lease. The Lend-Lease bill of late 1940 is actually the crowning achievement of the domestic New Deal, because it allows the engine of credit to be harnessed for, in this case, for defense production. But it shows how you can defeat any depression. And remember that U.S. unemployment disappeared during 1941, most of it gone before Pearl Harbor. So more and more problems for the Roosevelt haters and monetarists to put in their pipes and smoke. So in the meantime now, we have got to mount the mobilization. Let's keep this also in focus. Americans against fascism. And that means a three-phase program of resistance. The first phase during the time of these nominations. We'll get to some nominations in a minute. During the transition up to January 20th to try to stop the monstrosities coming out of this Washington conference, to try to make sure that the lame duck session of Congress is not too much of a disaster Then after that, the most harrowing period, I think, in recent memory will be the 100 days of Obama, the utopian hysteria, the attempt to impose the institutions of the fascist corporate state. And then if we survive that, a two-year perspective up until the November 2010 congressional elections, when hopefully the one-party monopoly in Washington, D.C. can be broken, we say no Obama, and that means no honeymoon. No fairness doctrine, no interference with free speech, no militias. We don't want any voluntary national security militia of Mussolini, nor do we want the Homeland Security Corps of Obama. No bailouts of Wall Street. We need financing to maintain industrial capacity and infrastructure, things that people need to eat, to wear, to live in, to drive, to use as tools. Yes, that, but not derivatives, because derivatives are none of those. No to the cap and trade, no to the demagogy of global warming, no to the carbon tax or any other monstrosity. No more free trade. Bush is trying to bootleg in a Colombian free trade deal. Will Barkey go along with it? It looks like he might. No to the confrontations with Russia, China, Sudan, and Pakistan that are being planned. No to the looting of Social Security, which is also in the works. And no wars. Obama, end the war in Afghanistan. Don't escalate it. End the war in Iraq. Don't prolong it into endless wars. So that's the program of Americans against fascism. Now let's look at, since we talked about these nominations, let's look at a couple of them. Who is going to be the head of the Central Intelligence Agency under Obama? Now, this is a person, he's going to have to commit federal crimes in order to get the job. Because remember, since Obama is not a citizen of the United States, according to our very best information, which he could easily refute, but doesn't, therefore meaning he can't, if you're the head of the CIA and you walk in and put a top secret document, no foreign, in front of Obama, you're committing a federal crime. So grit your teeth. Who's it going to be? Looks like it's going to be John Brennan. This, of course, is the national security advisor to the Obama campaign. We've talked about him before. During 2008, you remember the issue of FISA and Bush's wiretapping and how Obama promised that he would filibuster any retroactive immunity for the telecoms. It was Brennan who convinced Obama not only not to filibuster, but to vote for that retroactive immunity. Back in a minute. Crisis Radio, the final segment of this week's program, Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C., on the eve of the monstrosity, the International Financial Conference. The only thing we can hope for is that this conference will fail to approve anything. Let's hope for resistance coming from BRIC, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, above all the Russia and company, with perhaps some wild cards, maybe Italy, who knows. Joining in, and some other third world countries that we have not heard from yet. Remember, Obama, of course, is focused on institutional changes towards fascism. That will be the institutionalization of these militias in the Mussolini style and the destruction of talk radio, including the program and network that you're listening to right now. So important to fight Barkey Obama on all of that. This was a very narrow election victory for Obama, very disappointing when you consider the advantage in money, in fawning, media adulation, vote fraud courtesy of Acorn, and all the rest of it. A 52% victory is a wretched, miserable result given those advantages. This is not the realignment of anything. If we go back to V.O. Keyes' theory of critical elections, V.O. Key, a theory of critical elections written back in the 50s, I believe, identifies these times, 1828, 1860, 1896, 1932, 1968. This is still open-ended because there is no mandate for anything, and the Obama regime is much more likely to become an abortive interlude of the Carter type compared to anything else. The terrorist bomber, weatherman terrorist bomber Bill Ayers, was on Good Morning America today. He and Bernardine Dorn, other weatherman terrorist bomber, are coming out of their self-imposed incommunicado status, or Barkey-imposed incommunicado status, and he's prating about sewers of violence, how he wanted to end the war, and that he only targeted property, never killed any people. There's pretty good evidence that Ayers and Dorn were at least peripherally involved in the conspiracy to rob the Brinks armored car north of New York City in the early 1980s, which led to the death of several policemen and guards, and there are other deaths that occurred during the weatherman bombing period. What Ayers needs to do is come out and tell exactly the bombings that he participated in and what he did, and then we can look at it. But Ayers is not going to do that. Remember, as I've said before, and as you can read in Barack H. Obama, the unauthorized biography, the secret of Ayers and Dorn is that they hate the working class. These are anti-working class operatives. That was the big debate in Students for a Democratic Society. You had the Labor Committee tendency, which said, no, you've got to be pro-working class. And there were others, too. There were various that were pro-labor in one form or another. But the weathermen were the most extreme fascist anti-working class elements. And they basically said, no, the working class is integrated. They've accepted white skin privilege. The only hope here is race war. For the United States to be purged, we need the catharsis of a race war that will kill most of the population. But when you come out of it, you will have been freed from the curse of racism and imperialism. That's the weatherman program. That has not changed. And all evidence is that Barkey Obama is the best friend of Bill Ayers and Bernardine Dorn, that these are the elective affinities that reflect what he really believes. This guy, Obama, who is a reader of Fanon and Nietzsche, and anti-Western civilization. That's Obama. You can read all about that in Obama, the unauthorized biography. So don't fall for the attempted rehabilitation of Ayers and Dorn. Now, in terms of the autopilot, more and more we're looking at the Obama administration as basically a seamless continuation of the Bush policies. The Iraq war will not end. The Afghan war will be escalated. There's going to be very little difference. Ambassador Thomas Stevenson, U.S. ambassador to Portugal, told the meeting of the American Club of Lisbon this past week that there's practically no difference between Obama and Bush on foreign policy. The only thing we've got is the facelift, because Obama, the puppet. In other words, we've got a new puppet to come in and replace the old discredited puppet with a new fresh-faced puppet who can give the whole thing a facelift and a new lease on life to relaunch it into the world. It is now increasingly clear that Admiral Mullen of the Joint Chiefs of Staff will stay on. He will continue his warmongering ways. And that Robert Gates will stay on at the Pentagon. We've already discussed the role of John Brennan. This was the guy who convinced Barkey, or ordered him, to support the retroactive immunity for the telecom companies under the FISA renewal. Barkey had promised, remember, that he would filibuster retroactive immunity, and instead he voted for it. Some left libs should have woken up at that point, but of course left libs are pretty pathetic when it comes to this stuff. Now, let's take a look at Robert Gates. Remember, a couple of weeks ago, we had this interesting speech by Robert Gates with Jessica Matthews at the Carnegie Endowment when he reminisced. He said, oh, Jessica, remember when you and I were with Zbigniew Brzezinski and we met with Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister and the Defense Minister of Iran, the Foreign Minister being Yazdi, back in Algiers in the middle of 1978, and Brzezinski told the Iranians that he wanted to continue delivering all kinds of weapons to them because the Iranians and the United States faced a major enemy, and that, of course, was the Soviets, the Russians, to their north. Remember that Robert Gates, his ruling passion, just like that of Brzezinski, is that he's a CIA Russia specialist. He's a hater of Russia. And, of course, Gates goes back to Zbigniew Brzezinski, the big break in Gates's career was when Zbigniew Brzezinski made him his personal office boy at the National Security Council under Carter back during those trilateral years, 1977, 78, and 79. We even have these interesting quotes where Brzezinski says, Gates was the first person I saw every morning and the last person I saw every night. We actually have an interesting article by Robert Perry, and you can see this. You can reach it through antiwar.com. It's also available at consortiumnews.com. Robert Perry, former Newsweek correspondent, who reminds us interesting things. Remember the October surprise. You can read about that, actually, too, in my George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, 1992. The October surprise was a secret talks in Paris in October 1980 between representatives of the Carter regime, but not loyal to Carter anymore, and the Iranians. And the goal was to prevent the release of the U.S. hostages being held in Tehran at that time, after 450 days or whatever it was, because it was the, obviously they feared that if the hostages were released, Carter would win a second term, and Carter had done his work. He was about to be discarded by the trilateral bankers in the same way that Barack Obama will be at some point in the not-so-distant future. Remember that there was some stuff about this. The issue flared up in the early 90s. January 1993, there were congressional hearings about this. Gary Sick, remember him, talked about the question of the October surprise. At that point, things I didn't know. On 11th of January 1993, the Soviet government officially informed the United States that Robert Gates was part of the talks of George H.W. Bush with the Iranians in Paris in October 1980. And go look at this interesting article. Robert Perry has various sources telling him, when we started these October surprise hearings back in 1993, under the beginning of Clinton, we had so much information that there was no doubt that there had been indeed this violation of the Logan Act and really treason to prevent the hostages from being released in order to secure the election of Reagan, and that you know, Kissinger had been a part of this, and Gates and many, many others. But it was shut down by Lee Hamilton. So Lee Hamilton is an admirer of Robert Gates. So this, of course, is the same Robert Gates who was the founder of Al-Qaeda during the time that he worked for Brzezinski in the National Security Council and then later on in the early 1980s. So Robert Gates, a tremendous threat. Read all about it. Robert Perry, consortiumnews.com, antiwar.com. And time for Americans Against Fascism. And do everything possible to block this monstrosity this weekend. Spread the word. Get that leaked document that I have up there about the IMF secret world dictatorship. And we'll be back next week, fairness, doctrine willing,